Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Do you agree that success in life is mostly determined by things outside of our control? Americans disagree with that statement vehemently.
Does the way our language describes action influence how we think of it?
The causal structure of the world looks nothing like what English wants it to look like. English speakers pay attention to who did it, even when it's accidental.
Did Justin Timberlake rip off Janet Jackson's bodice, or did a wardrobe malfunction occur?
Everyone can see what happened. Everyone should be able to remember the same thing. Everyone should describe it the same way, and that's just not what we find.
Can our language really influence how we blame and punish people?
Our guest is Stanford psychologist Lera Boroditsky.
There's so many things to remember about any given event. Something has to tell you what to focus on, and language can do that.
Who done it? The Language of Responsibility.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today is whodunit. The language of responsibility.
Now, by the language of responsibility, we mean the way we report events for which someone might be held responsible, that is, praised or blamed or punished.
For example, in reporting a famous event witnessed by millions of Super Bowl fans on television, I might say Justin Timberlake ripped off Janet Jackson's blouse, revealing her naked chest.
You're describing an action for which Timberlake might be held responsible, and with him, CBS, for exposing the young, innocent Super Bowl watchers of the world to a naked breast.
However, that's not the way Timberlake described it. He said that as he reached across Janet's blouse, a wardrobe malfunction occurred. He described the same event, but without a person to hold responsible for opening the blouse.
Now, presumably he thought that that made him sound less culpable, John.
But millions of people saw it. They saw Timberlake reach across Janet Jackson's blouse, unclip something, her blouse fall open, and her breast be exposed. Even if that wasn't his intention, it's clear that he did it. Shakespeare said that a rose smells as sweet no matter what one calls it. Anyone who witnessed that Super Bowl moment should realize it was something Timberlake was responsible, no matter how it's described.
But you know what, John? I hate to tell you this, that interestingly enough, Shakespeare was actually wrong. You can prove it empirically.
Tell me more.
So if you blindfold people and ask them to smell an aroma, what you call the aroma has a big effect on how pleasant they find it. If you call it a rose, they'll probably like it. If you call it just a flower, they'll like it, but not as much. If you say it's a plant, they'll like it even less, and on and on.
Sounds like Shakespeare loses, Timberlake wins.
Right. Now, suppose you show two group of people the same footage from the Super Bowl, and you say to group A, you're going to see a video where Justin Timberlake reaches across the front of Janet Jackson's body, unfastens the snap, and tears part of the bodice. To the other group, you say, Timberlake reaches across the front of Jackson's body. A snap unfastens, and part of the bodice tears. So, what would happen if you ask, was this Timberlake's fault? Should someone be fined? What do you think will happen?
Well, I think what should happen is it shouldn't make any difference. Both groups see the same event. It's obvious that Timberlake did it, even if it wasn't what he meant to do. It wasn't just spontaneous bodice combustion, right? The second description doesn't say that he didn't do it. It's like when President Reagan said about the Iran-Contra affair, mistakes were made. Well, if mistakes were made, somebody made them. And if the bodice was torn, somebody tore it. But I suspect that what I think should happen isn't what you're going to tell me really happens.
You got it right, John. The first group is much more likely to assign responsibility and level a fine, and a large one at that.
And as I understand it, this is an aspect where there are actually differences among languages.
You're right again, John. You're on fire. Suppose that we're eyewitnesses who think the bodice tearing was unintentional and accidental, a true wardrobe malfunction, as Timberlake put it.
Okay.
Well, in that case, especially in English, either description is still okay. But in a language like Spanish, the eyewitness who thinks it was an accident is much more likely to use the bodice tore, a verb that avoids giving responsibility.
And is that important?
It's very important, because the effect carries over to memory. Often, the way we describe things affects how we encode the memories of them. If we describe what happened without mentioning who did what to whom, we're much worse. We're much worse at remembering who was actually responsible. And people whose language prefer descriptions like the bodice tore, like in Spanish, are less likely to recall the responsible parties.
Now, our guest who will be here in a bit is Lara Boroditsky, one of our favorite guests, a psychologist. And of course, being a psychologist, she can prove these effects with many experiments. Lots of graphs, more statistics than you ever want to see, and all sorts of fascinating stuff like that. But you and I need to explain why this is philosophically interesting.
Well, it's philosophically interesting because there's actually a whole series of conclusions we might draw from this work. For one, language seems to shape thought. Language seems to affect how we think of events, even when we're eyewitnesses. How it describes shapes how we think.
And we might speculate even further. We might suppose that given the way the language of action and responsibility varies across languages and cultures, perhaps the very conception of responsibility does too. Maybe Puritanism can be traced to the way English makes us focus on the person who does something, even when these actions are unintentional and accidental.
Well, look, John, let's not get carried away here. We better get some help from somebody who knows some real facts, the psychologist herself. That would be Lara Boroditsky, who will be joining us in a couple of minutes.
And we want our live audience here at the Marsh to join us, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, talks to someone who deals with responsibility and accountability in the prison system. She files this report.
What if inmates could unlearn violence? What if, over a 20-week period, they could reverse the patterns of violence that have been ingrained over a lifetime? One man believes that by changing the way offenders talk about violence and responsibility, they can change their behavior and peacefully return to society.
After a year, only 80% of the men who had gone through the program did not return to the program. So it was actually a turn the recidivism statistics upside down.
Hamish Sinclair is the founder of Man Alive, a restorative justice program for men in jails around the San Francisco Bay Area. Man Alive is kind of like group therapy, facilitated by former violent offenders.
It's the peer setting, I think, that really counts. We train the men coming into the class to learn how to teach other men how to stop their violence.
Sinclair believes in order to transform whole neighborhoods, you have to start with individuals.
We do it by addressing the belief system that drives the violence, which we call the male role belief system, and that's in short, Mr. BS.
First, men learn that they're part of a bigger, misogynistic society.
Can we get some examples? What's the male role belief system you learn?
Boys don't cry.
Take it like a man.
Women are supposed to do what I say.
Why?
Because I'm a man.
Then, they discuss what landed them in jail.
I've caught, like, armed robbery. I've had assault with great bodily injuries. And I've shot, you know, a couple people.
They learn to take responsibility for their actions. They work through situations that trigger violence and focus on alternatives.
See, the only reason why I would come close to somebody is to check how close I can get, right? But not to stay there. I'd find out how close I can get to where, okay, he feels uncomfortable. Let me step back, right? And make myself safe.
Sinclair argues that when talking about violence, we tend to verbalize it in ways that allow us to skirt responsibility.
The very word violence is a passive term. I do my violence. You never ever see people say, I violated you.
Inmates are coached to own up to their actions. The program has its own vernacular. Fatal peril, for example, refers to that moment before a violent outburst, when you can either lose it or handle the situation another way.
So who is that moment really deadly to?
My hitman.
It's deadly to your image, man. It's not deadly to Tay yet.
No.
But in that moment, it feels like my image dying, right?
Yeah.
Man Alive is part of a larger program, Resolve to Stop the Violence, or RSVP, that brings offenders back into society by working both with victims and the community. And they've had great results.
If you take any population of violent men in jail or out of jail, there's about 20% of them absolutely refuse to change. And we tend to want to get rid of them right away. Because there's 60% in the middle who'll go either way to change or not change.
Hamish Sinclair hopes the small percentage of those who really want to change will lead the rest. But he's the first to admit it doesn't always work.
A man who was an excellent senior advocate, was able to teach very well, got out of the program and went back onto speed and crack and actually killed his wife.
There are more than 140,000 state prisoners in California. A court ruled recently that overcrowding is so bad, the state has to reduce the prison population by more than 30,000 over the next couple of years. Sinclair worries that if he doesn't show convicts how to deal with violence and reintegrate back into society, no one will. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
And we're joined now by Lara Boroditsky. She's a professor of psychology at Stanford University. She's author of many, many things, including a recent fascinating article in Scientific American entitled How Language Shapes Thought. Lara, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Lara, this work on the language of responsibility is part of your overall project on how language and culture influence thinking. How did you get interested in this particular aspect of that big problem?
You know, I got started thinking about how we describe events. And events in the world are really complicated. They need to be construed. Even the simplest of events needs to be construed. So let me give you an example. When Dick Cheney went out hunting with his friend Harry Whittington, he ended up having an accident. So he accidentally shot Harry Whittington in the face. Now, this is a split-second event, split-second physical event. What could be simpler? But there's so many different ways to describe it. So we could say Cheney shot Whittington, or we could say Whittington got shot by Cheney, or we could leave Cheney out altogether. We could say Whittington got shot. We could say what Cheney actually said when he was he gave this interview where he took full responsibility for the event, and this is what he said. Ultimately, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry. So it's
a really stand-up guy.
Later he goes on to say, no, it wasn't Harry's fault. So that was very nice, very nice of him. Not my friend's fault that I shot him in the face. But that's a way of distancing yourself from the outcome where he essentially made three events out of one. Bush actually did one better. Bush said, he heard a bird flush and he turned and pulled the trigger and saw his friend get wounded. So there, Cheney transforms from agent to mere witness within a single sentence. That is a masterful exculpation.
So, but on your view, it's not just different grammatical structures are exploited by people to reduce or increase their role in something that's blameworthy or praiseworthy, but this is embedded in language and in culture. Tell us more about that aspect of it.
Yeah, so languages differ. Languages allow us all these different ways of construing events, but languages differ in terms of which ways you're likely to talk about an event, which is the normal or canonical way to talk about it. So my student, Caitlin Fossey, had just been studying in Chile, and she started noticing that the way you describe events in Spanish is quite different than in English. And lots of bilinguals notice this, that in languages like Spanish, if something happened accidentally, you're more likely to say, it happened, as opposed to, I did it. So if you've lost a library book, you don't go to the librarian and say, I lost the book. You say, the book lost itself to me. That's the way you're supposed to say it.
So maybe it was deep sympathy and familiarity with the Mexican people that led Bush and Cheney to talk in this way.
Well, right. And I've got to try this one on my wife. I often say, I didn't drop the vase. The vase dropped. And she gets a little upset at me when I do this thing. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. We're asking, who done it? And looking at the language of responsibility with Stanford psychologist Lara Boroditsky.
If you unintentionally do something terrible and get sued, should you hope for a Spanish-speaking jury? Should we all hope that God speaks Spanish? Are English speakers unusually and irrationally judgmental? What can we learn by comparing cultures?
Linguistic relativity and attributing responsibility, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Judge Judy, I'm handsome and charming. I possess a disarming cachet. My behavior is never alarming, so long as I get my own way.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I think we're all relieved that Merle's bodice remained intact. Unlike Janet Jackson's, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the language of responsibility with Stanford psychologist Lera Boroditsky.
Are you bilingual? Can you tell us whether you think of responsibility differently in your two languages? Do you think one language is better than another for talking about responsibility and for thinking about responsibility? Join the discussion by stepping up to one or the other microphones at either end of the stage.
So, Lera, I think your experiments and your studies are really cool, as always. You do this really cool work, really creative. And I'm convinced that the language we choose has effects on how we perceive and remember an event. But what I want to know is how deep does this really go? I mean, does it really show, do Spaniards, for example, and English speakers, do they really have different conceptions of what it takes for a person to be responsible for it? I mean, could the librarian ever say to that Spaniard who said, how was it the book was lost to me or something like that? Could the librarian ever say, no, you lost the book, dude, because you had the book? I mean, does it go deep or is it superficial?
I think it's not just on the surface. So there are lots of ways that we as psychologists can measure whether or not it goes beyond the surface. So we can look at what people pay attention to an event. Do they remember who did it? Do they pay attention to who was the guy that spilled the water or who was the guy that lost the book? And English speakers pay attention to who did it even when it's accidental. Whereas speakers of Spanish or Japanese, languages that are less likely to talk about an agent, are less likely to pay attention to that. More likely to pay attention to other things. You can also ask, if you speak agentively, just within English, are you more likely to blame someone? Are you more likely to try to find them? And in those cases, we find that it matters as well.
Right, that goes back to that thing we talked about at the opening. If you frame it with the agentive, the Justin Timberlake did this, right, versus you frame it non-agentively, this happened, right, while Justin Timberlake, but then that your studies, these are your studies, right, that show that people are more likely to blame, raise fines, and all that sort of stuff. So, right, if you're paying attention to the agency, that seems right because the agentive descriptions, to use a kind of fancy term, raises the agent to saliency. When you raise something to saliency, but I mean, suppose there's people looking at a scene of Justin Timberlake going about, and we don't describe it in any way. We don't prime the pump. Are Japanese speakers less likely to focus on who did what to whom than English speakers? I mean, just give them a description and say, describe it.
That's exactly the studies that we've done. So we've done studies where we show people videos, intentional actions and accidental actions. We don't describe those videos at all. Everyone sees what happens. And you might imagine, everyone can see what happened. Everyone should be able to remember the same thing. Everyone should describe it the same way. And that's just not what we find. Depending on the patterns that exist in your language that are most prominent in your language, people will remember different things. There's so many things to remember about any given event. Something has to tell you what to focus on, and language can do that.
Now, as English speakers, or as an English speaker, I'm inclined to think, well, that's kind of sad. These poor Spanish people aren't noticing what's important about the library book, namely who lost it. The agent's the important thing in a case like that, and how distorting of language to make them miss it. But there's another perspective. There have been studies I've read, probably connected with your work, that when you think about a crime wave, if you think of the crime wave from this agential point of view, then you'll say, well, who did it? What do we do? How do we punish them? If you think of it more as kind of a virus, right, and take that kind of model of it, you take very different measures. And sometimes those are much better. Sometimes the agental way of, I mean, if, for example, after the Justin Timberlake case, there had been just cases of bodice dropping all over television, people might say, well, let's find out in each case who did it and find the bejesus out of them. But another approach might have been say, well, that's really not the salient thing. Why is this one leading to this other case? What can we do to prevent it? Can we keep them off YouTube and stuff like that?
Certainly paying attention to the circumstances that surround an event is also really important. And there isn't, in almost any event, there isn't just one cause. There's lots of things that could potentially be causal. In English, we like to focus on a person as a single cause and simplify it for ourselves that way. But you could focus on any number of other things. But certainly English also can be made to sound unreasonable. So in English, you can say things like, I broke my arm. Now, in lots of languages, you can't say I broke my arm unless you're crazy. I mean, why would you go out and intentionally try to break your arm?
Right.
That makes no sense.
Right.
And so languages really differ in how comfortable they feel putting someone in that agenda.
Okay, you talked about languages. But what about people and cultures coming first and the language kind of following? Because, okay, take my wife. My wife's a wonderful person. A wonderful person.
Why would you give her away?
She's Japanese American.
It's kind of a heady Youngman stick.
In her subculture, she grew up, you do not ask direct questions. You ask questions from which people, it's just impolite to ask a direct question. You do not make direct assertions about what somebody did. You talk about what happened in a way, but you get out that they did it, right? And they're the ones who should be ashamed or something. But you don't just say, you should be ashamed. You just don't do that, right? It's just a way of talking, though. She has perfect command of English. She's a native English speaker, but she still doesn't talk this way. She talks in this indirect way. Could it be that, you know, in certain cultures, people are just more indirect, less direct?
I think that's definitely true. Language and culture, of course, go hand in hand. Language is one part of culture. And when you make a way of talking that, for example, if I have to talk agentively about who did what, then I have to remember who did it. That means I have to pay attention to who did it. If I don't have to talk about it, then I don't pay attention to it. I may develop cultural practices that also go along with that. These things can and do drive each other.
So it's not an either-or thing. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about whodunit, the language of responsibility, with our guest Lara Boroditsky from Stanford Psychology Department. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. We'd love to have questions from that audience, so come up to the microphones on either side. There's one on this side, and there's one on that side. And we're going to start on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Tom from Napa. I wanted to focus on the more serious subject of fault and culpability. It was mentioned that there are many causes. And in America, and through our language, we put a lot of emphasis on the individual, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the conditions. And this makes it very difficult to take into consideration mitigating circumstances when you're being judged. And so we tend to have more people, it's said, in jail than in other countries. So I would ask you, is this reflected, this difference, in the criminal activity, or let's say the incarceration in other countries? If you are putting less emphasis on agency, does it mean we see fewer people in jails in other parts of the world?
I can't point you to data that says the patterns in a particular language lead to this incarceration rate. But it's definitely the case that intuitively, when we think about what to do about a criminal, what to do to achieve justice, the thing that seems most intuitive is you find the person who did it, you find out exactly how much they are to blame, then you punish them accordingly, and when you've done that, that justice has been served. That's what it means to achieve justice. But a very different approach might be to say, find the victim, figure out how wronged they were, restitute them appropriately, and only then justice has been done, right? That's a very different approach, and that's not the first approach that comes to mind, at least in the American context. And some people have made the connection that perhaps it's because we're so focused on the agent and who did it that our first response in achieving justice is just to put people in jail. We certainly do have the highest incarceration
so
rate.
So in your line of work, people talk about thinking for speaking. Do I have that right? Right, so that your language has certain kind of resources. You have to communicate in that language, so you have to think in ways that language makes easily available or something like that and exploits. I mean, is it possible that the highly agentive focus of English somehow shapes just that alone, somehow shapes, you know, is partly responsible for our radical individualism, for our always looking for the agent who's at the center rather than systemic causes, rather than background causes? I mean, is that a plausible hypothesis?
I think it's part of a system. I don't think it could do it on its own, but I think it's definitely part of a linguistic system that supports, that has lots of other supports for having only one cause, for having relatively simplistic one thing did it, and X caused Y. English likes these kinds of constructions, and as a result, it's a lot easier for us to think that way. But you find really big cultural differences in how many causes people will allow, how many steps back in a causal chain people are willing to go. And
give an example of that, because you cited, I read something in one of your papers about how many steps backwards.
Yeah, so in these studies, you look at a pool table, and you say, okay, I'm going to make a shot. Now, look at this table. How responsible is the shot that I just made for the arrangement of the balls? Everyone will say that that shot is responsible. You say, what about the shot before that? And what about the shot before that? And so on. Americans are willing to go basically one shot back. That's as far back as we're willing to go. But Korean students are willing to go as many as seven shots back. They believe that there's a much deeper causal chain. Many more things are actually likely to feed into the current state. And there are lots of other evidence where people in other cultures are much more willing to look to past events and past experience as being causally important in the present moment.
So there's a conception in philosophy called an Inus condition, mm-hmm. which means an insufficient but necessary part of an unnecessary but sufficient condition.
And if you got that.
Well, the basic idea is it's the last thing that's needed. Mm-hmm. And we tend to focus on the last things that's needed and call it the cause, right? Why did the train crash? The wheel fell off the boxcar. Well, of course, it had to be moving. It had to be moving around a curve. It had to be moving at a certain speed. All sorts of things were required for the crash to happen. But the last thing that had to happen, or whether you mean temporally or in our conception of it, the one that's somehow salient, the one that somehow we imagine should have been different, we call that the cause. That's a really deep part of human thinking. But the whole activity of science kind of goes the other way, right?
Right.
That to really understand something, you have to know not just what the last thing was and take all the rest for granted, but you have to know all these parameters. So what you're telling us is English is an unscientific and juvenile language.
It allows us to make only very simple, it leads us to make only very simple causal chains. And in fact, it often takes scientists a really long time to arrive at a circular notion of causality. So earlier we were talking about language and culture, and people wanted either language to shape culture or culture to shape language. Mm-hmm. And when I say both influence each other, that's confusing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and they're full of questions, and we'll go to this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you very much. Joda Jensen from Novato. Taking into consideration agency and causation, and let's say assume science is a language unto itself, do you find the differences in cultures approaching science differently because of how they look at these things or the underlying philosophical differences of the language they're using?
There are certainly very different philosophical traditions that come from different cultures, and they definitely differ in terms of whether they look at analytical relationships, again, one thing causes another, or more holistic, take more holistic approaches where you have to look at the whole system of interrelationships to be able to determine what's going on.
But I suppose there's a question that let's call it the totalizing power of Western science and its analysis of the causal structure of the world may be driving out all these local differences in language. I mean, the world shares science, more or less. I mean, is that a possibility? I mean, can local languages kind of override what science is telling us about how the causal structure of the world works?
Well, the causal structure of the world looks nothing like what English wants it to look like, right?
Oh,
the causal
kidding.
Structure of the world is very complicated. And there are many causal loops, and there are many, many interrelationships. So I think if science is really showing us what the structure of the world is, then eventually we're going to have to move away from the more simple ways that we talk about causal knowledge.
On this side of the room, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm Jess from San Francisco. So, Lira, you've done some really interesting work on how we empirically view agency. There seems to be another discussion going on really how we should view agency. So Professor Perry and Taylor, what does Lira's work tell us about how we actually should view agency? Should we hold Justin Timberlake accountable for pulling down Janet's?
Well, there's a long philosophical problem about responsibility called free will. And the question is, does that I'll try to deal with quickly. Does Lara's research tell us anything about that? I think it does. I think there's a deep fantasy on one side of the free will argument, which is if you're truly responsible for an action, you're not just responsible for doing it, you're responsible for those character traits that you had that led you to do it. And you, moreover, you're responsible for having whatever character traits led you to have those character traits. The natural conclusion of that is you're not responsible for anything because the whole thing's incoherent. But this is a deeply held view on the part of many philosophers. And I think Lara's point of view suggests that whole stream of thinking is related to kind of parochial ways of looking at agency.
I think that's a really important part. There's a lot. Psychologists have a lot more data than philosophers' intuition would let them believe is out there about these complicated structures. And we can dig into that after a break. But for now, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whodunit and discussing the language of responsibility with psychologist Lara Boroditsky.
To what extent is our morality shaped by our language? Do our intuitions about what's just and unjust, right and wrong, praiseworthy and blameworthy, really depend on our grammar?
We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Stream. 10,000 lambs all drifted by, empty of their dreams. Oh, I would wish for wisdom now, the only thing I've learned. All the warmth you desire means something must get burned.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the language of responsibility with Lara Boroditsky from Stanford University. We've got a whole lot of questioners. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, thank you. My name is Josie Lair. I'm curious about if you have any historic perspective on the impact of naming crimes. My family is from Chile, and we conducted the first quantitative study of sexual assault and partner violence on a college campus there. And there was a high rate of people, men and women, reporting experiences that would amount to our definition of attempted rape or rape, often by an acquaintance, dating partner. And yet, almost no one reported it to the police. And a salient reason was, I don't think that what happened to me was a crime. Mm-hmm. And so, in one of the papers that we wrote, we suggested words, phrases in Spanish to reflect the concept of date rape and acquaintance rape. And I'm curious, you know, on the one hand, maybe people who experience something like this, who don't give it a name, you know, maybe they have a difficult experience and it's confusing and then it goes away. Mm-hmm. You know, on the other hand, if they name themselves as a rape survivor, you know, what is the impact of that for them? And so I'm just curious, and also things like marital rape, you know, which is a phrase that came into being in recent history, crime of passion of, you know, a man killing his wife who he finds with another man, which is permissible still in Brazil, I believe. You know, what is the impact of naming crimes?
I think it's an important question, naming anything. Because there used to be this apparently not true thought, story, apparently wrongly attributed to Sapir and Whorf, that the Eskimos had all these words for snow, they didn't have a word for general snow, and philosophers used to go crazy about this kind of thing. They would say, oh, look, even if they don't have a word for snow, they can have a phrase, you know, even if they have more word, even if we don't have word for all their kind of snow, we can have a description of all that sort of stuff. And you might think, what difference does having a word for something make? But I actually have come to believe that having a word, having a name for something, a single word, is a big important social thing, because it makes it, I mean, you could have a phrase, well, my husband did this thing to me which involved blah, 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 right? That's a long, complicated description, but if I have a one word reference to it, he raped me, and then rape can have all these associations associated with it, whether they're semantic or extra semantic, doesn't matter, then it becomes a certain kind of vehicle in our shared life that a long description isn't. So I've come to believe having a word for something is a way of singling it out and raising it to salience, and it does shape how we view things. What do you think?
I think having a word allows a really ready construal of what happened, as the questioner was describing. The world is very complicated, and our events are often confusing. It's hard to know what to make of them. And so when we have a word or a ready expression, that gives you a ready construal, a ready way of thinking about what happened, a very compact way of representing
it. I think the readiness is important, though, because it's not as though you couldn't think, he did something terrible to me, and then describe it, and people would say, oh, that is terrible. But having a word encodes that terribleness in a...
There's really two issues here. One is that to give a possibly complex phenomenon, but think... To give it a name, to devote a word to it, suggests that it's important, that it's going to reoccur, that it's worth remarking on, and, you know, so just having a name is important. But also, using a name that's already been used for something else can be a very powerful thing. And the question of marital rape came up. That was really a big issue. Lots of debates on either side, and one idea was, well, if we have a word for it, and it's precisely defined as the forcing to have sexual relations by a married couple, what does it matter whether we call it rape or not? And the answer, of course, is, well, we got all these laws, we got all these things that are in people's minds that use the word rape, and you plug right into that if you use the same word. Of course, there it seems like a good idea. In other cases, it can be a very bad idea. It can be the danger of metaphor and the associations you get. So I agree with Ken and John Locke. Words are important.
So you want to respond to that?
Certainly the way juries respond to a description of an event really differs depending on what you say. So if you say, when did he kiss you, as opposed to, when did he force oral contact on you?
Right.
One of those sounds a lot nicer than the other, right? And so if you say, when did he kiss you, that kind of implies some kind of a nice consensual action. Maybe you were also involved in the kiss. That's very different from forced oral contact. And it brings to mind a very different mental image.
Let's get some more of our listeners here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm Ludmila Eggleton from Walnut Creek, and I would like to again go back to English language, being bilingual, Russian English, and Russian was my first language, and I'm a scientist as well. So I kind of noticed myself that indeed, when I'm write something, especially scientific, but not just scientific in English, it's actually always come out much shorter than if I wanted to write the same thing in Russian. And I just wonder, it looks like English language has more, as you mentioned, specific words for different things, just one, and it's expressed so many things. I just wondering, does it shape mentality of English-speaking world that is different from very much the rest?
You and Lara share something. She's a native Russian speaker, a scientist, and bilingual too, so you want to respond to that?
Sure. It's very tempting to make hypotheses like this language is better for science and this other language is better for oratory. And people have been making claims like that for as long as there have been languages. So, and usually the claims go that whatever language you happen to speak is the best one for thought. So the French for a while argued that English was completely an impossible language for thinking clearly in because the
well,
French
it's certainly an impossible language for romance. French is much better for romance.
But the French philosophers argued that French was much better for logical thought precisely because the structure of French captured so beautifully the structure of human thinking. Of course, the thinking of French speakers.
Yeah, right.
There may have been a coincidence there. So far, all of the research on how particular features of language shape thought have focused on particular expressions. You have this grammatical expression or you don't. You're more likely to express it this way or that way. And they don't really license these kinds of broad claims. All languages, of course, by definition, allow their speakers to succeed in reproducing and continuing their culture. So all languages have a huge amount of value to their speakers. They all allow us to be very flexible.
On this side of the auditorium, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My name is Mari Gonzalez. I'm a bilingual, and I'm a former ESL teacher and an interpreter. I'm also studying intercultural relations. So I disagree with you in terms of language affects culture. I believe language is the medium in which culture is passed on and maintained. And one of the biggest differences between Americans or English speakers and Spanish speakers and the rest of the world is that identity. English speakers or Americans identified, you know, by themselves. I am who I am because I'm unique. The rest of the world will be said to be called collectivist. You know, I am because I'm part of a group. And that has huge implications about taking responsibility. For example, in conflict resolution, if I come from a collectivist culture, I'm more sensitive about the relationship. And if the relationship has been damaged, then what's the point of talking? And Americans or English speakers will want to focus on the task, on the action, not about the person. And also, you know, as a bilingual person, I rather do business in English. Like whenever I call AT&T for complaining, even if they're bilingual, you know, let me tell you why. This is funny because, you know, if it's a Spanish speaker, we are circular. We go around and around. And in English, it's to the point. I think English is the best language for business because it's very task-oriented. Blah, 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 done.
What do you think about that, Laura?
I think she should listen to some of our conference calls. She might.
Do you want to respond to that?
This again goes, you know, people do have these intuitions about what languages are better for what. So Frederick the Great of Prussia a long time ago said something like, I speak English to my accountants, French to my ambassadors, Italian to my mistress, Latin to my God, and German to my horse. That was his definition of what languages are best for what. Not based on empirical evidence, but it is very tempting. But the fact that people have these intuitions, I think, is very interesting. It does tell you something, that there's something there to investigate. Why is it that people feel so differently when they're speaking one language or another?
But her broader point is not inconsistent with your research, that there might be cultural differences, but the cultures exploit these linguistic differences. I mean, it's not clear what the direction of causality has to be consistent with your research. It seems to me your research can support, okay, there are these cultural differences, the language encodes these cultural differences. It doesn't have to be the language causes these. Isn't that the right way to read your research?
I think language is one part of culture, and I completely agree that language carries a lot of cultural information. Languages also acquire structures for internal reasons that have nothing to do with cultural information. So sometimes you have to satisfy a structural constraint, and so you end up with a particular pattern.
Well, maybe last question.
Yeah, hi, I'm Kylie from Oakland. I just want to say briefly, it seems to take a certain level of maturity or sophistication to ever be able to take accountability for anything. And we know that, you know, children are always denying things that they do. And we learn that in relationships that seem to work take a communication style where people are able to use, you know, there's this nonviolent communication mode of communicating where someone says, I feel blank when you do X. And even though we seem to know that this is a really positive thing to be able to take accountability and ownership for what you do, it seems to be really hard for everyone. And I think I'm just really curious about why it's so difficult to take ownership for your actions.
You got any insight into that? That's not really your bailiwick.
It's certainly easier to think agentively about other people's actions than it is about your own. There are lots and lots of studies showing this, that when you watch someone else do something bad and you're asked why, you say it's because they're a bad person. But if you do the same thing and you're asked why, then you list all the circumstances that required you to perform that way, and it's not because you're a bad person. So that is well known. But there are also cultural differences in the degree to which people will ascribe people's actions to circumstances. So there are cultures where you watch someone do something bad and you don't necessarily say they're a bad person. You look at the circumstances and you say, well, other people in the same set of circumstances would act the same way. So that allows you a different way of understanding what leads people to.
Here's a non-psychologist sort of half philosophical thought. People are bad at taking responsibility because people are basically confabulators about themselves. People tell themselves all kinds of stories that put them. Have you ever known a rich, privileged person? Just ask yourself this. Have you ever known a rich, privileged person who did not think their wealth and privilege was deserved? Have you ever known a downtrodden person who did not think their downtroddenness was undeserved? So people are pretty good at construing the other as responsible for their situation and not construing them, you know, so or justifying it when they do good. You know, somebody told me, somebody scores a touchdown, they thank Jesus. They get tackled, they don't thank Jesus, right?
So people around the world are asked the same question by the Pew organization. They're asked, do you agree that success in life is mostly determined by things outside of our control? Americans disagree with that statement vehemently.
Yeah.
So 90% will say, that's absolutely false. I think it's within, the most important stuff is stuff that we do. And people in other places think that statement is much more agreeable. There are sometimes reversals as big as 90% will agree with that statement.
So clearly, for every American, the biggest reason for their success was the luck of being born in America.
That's right. It's a big factor.
Very last question.
Okay, hi. I'm Paul from Oakland. I'm just sitting here thinking about cultural differences, but there are ways that people claim that they have ways of thinking that are universal over all cultures. Like, I'm thinking about religions, and I'm thinking about the whole idea of how morality is seen in religion, but what you're saying is that different cultures are going to have different ideas about what this means. Like, what is the difference between how a Buddhist in Japan and a Buddhist in the U.S. are going to see the idea of karma, or a Catholic in Spain and a Catholic in the U.S. are going to see the whole idea of being responsible for sin? So,
definitely religions, as they travel the world, get modified and get interpreted in ways that are going to be consistent with the local culture and practice. And you see this when you find Islam, for example, in Indonesia. It's going to be a very different kind of Islam than you find in Saudi Arabia. I can talk to folks in Indonesia about Islam, but they also sort of believe in reincarnation, and they may also sort of believe in ancestor souls and things like that. A lot of belief systems get integrated in particular ways, in local ways, in ways that make sense to you.
On that note, Lara, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a very stimulating conversation, as always.
Thanks. It's been fun.
Our guest has been Lara Boroditsky. She's a professor of psychology at Stanford University. She's a very prolific author and very important psychologist. She's an author, for the purposes of this conversation, of a recent fascinating article in Scientific American entitled How Language Shapes Thought.
And we also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we point the finger at Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Ralph Reed, former chief of the Christian Coalition, was quoted in Politico about Newt Gingrich's adulteries and his ambitions to become president. Quote, I just reject the argument that Newt's past would be a liability. I think as long as he's prepared to confront those challenges, people's inclination will be forgiving. Unquote. This is the same Ralph Reed who said of Bill Clinton, we will not rest until we have leaders of good moral character. So forgiveness of adultery depends on who is doing the adulterating, or maybe it's only the Clintons that give conservatives pause. Hillary Clinton wrote a book, It Takes a Village, which says that raising children is a community responsibility. Conservatives took issue because Hillary Clinton wrote it. Bob Dole, when he was running for president, said, it does not take a village to raise a child. It takes a family to raise a child. Well, a family is part of a village, isn't it? Villagers like preachers, teachers, lawyers, therapists, counselors, and police get involved in child rearing as well. Many Christians believe in original sin. But opinions vary as to where that leaves us, somewhere in between innate total depravity and a tendency to do bad things. When it comes to morality, sin can be a get-out-of-jail-free card. You can open up with a machine gun at the mall, but if you find Jesus afterwards, God forgives you, and so should the world. I got an email regarding Earth Day from Doug Phillips, head of Vision Forum Ministries, a fundamentalist outfit that's all about homeschooling, Calvinism, and a catalog that sells toy crossbows to boys and pink toy ovens to girls. The email calls environmentalists sanitized pantheists who worship creatures instead of the Creator. The earth is not the problem, he writes. The reason why the earth suffers is because of man's sin that has plunged the earth into judgment. Well, tell that to BP, Doug. They'll be glad to hear it. Then maybe we'll sue God for the oil spill instead of them. I read that Hurricane Katrina was God's punishment to New Orleans for its decadence. Pat Robertson said that the earthquake in Haiti happened because the Haitians had made a pact with the devil to get freedom from the French. God hates voodoo democracy. I've read that the tsunami in Japan was God's punishment for World War II, Buddhism, and or tentacle rape porn. Is there a tipping point to depravity before bad things happen? If you have a village of 500 and one of them is gay, does that merit a landslide? Or the mayor spraining his ankle on a tree root? If lightning strikes a preacher, is God punishing him for his sins or just testing our faith? Even though I'm just another sanitized pantheist, I take at least one conservative point. If I live in a village, why should your child be my responsibility? Does it take a village to pay my rent? What if the village is Jonestown? Shouldn't you be getting your kids out of there? On the other hand, if the tsunami's coming, you should probably take the village and kids to high ground pronto. Leave the prayers and the blame for later. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University Copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Patrick Keane and Stephanie Weissman.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Merle Kessler, Joshua Raul Brody, David Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Ben Hirsch is our director of research. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable, the conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.